It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, this year's college women's basketball tournament wrapped up yesterday and set records for TV viewership, at points even surpassing the audience for the NBA's ESPN broadcast. We'll talk to a sports writer about what has people excited about the sport and where it goes from here. Now, a lot of Wisconsinites report feeling politically divided and civically disengaged. The Center for Communication and Civic Renewal at UW-Madison conducted a recent survey of Wisconsin residents. It focused on where those fractures are happening and how we might be able to build a healthier political climate. The idea is to strengthen democracy in the state and build upon shared values of civic health, even when we disagree politically. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you see these political divides, these civic fractures in your life? Have you stopped talking about politics with friends and family, or stop talking to friends and family because of politics? Have you been able to bridge a political divide with someone you disagree with? Do you feel able to participate in politics by voting, volunteering, getting involved in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mike Wagner is a journalism professor and faculty director of the Center for Communication and Civic Renewal at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here, Rob.
Before we dig into the finer points of what you've learned from Wisconsinites, remind us the mission, the goal, what you're trying to find out here.
We really want to understand how Wisconsinites are experiencing democracy and how the way that they kind of engage in their overall information ecology, where they get their news, who they talk to, whether they're posting about politics and social media or not, how all those things kind of mix together to help us understand where we can find places to agree and how we can disagree in healthier ways than some of us might be.
Let's start with the parts that you found worrisome. And you, in the report, you characterized some things as disturbing. What stood out to you as the worst news you encountered?
I would say there were a couple of things, one of which was that 60% of Wisconsinites have stopped talking about politics with someone with whom they disagree. And I think that's bad for a couple of reasons, because you might stop talking politics because you don't want to engage anymore. Maybe you feel like you can't defend your argument, and so you walk away, or maybe you find it annoying, or maybe you find it anxiety-producing to have to debate politics. But it also could be that you stop talking politics with somebody because somebody said things that made you feel like who you are doesn't count, or that you don't have a place in the state, or that it's okay for you to feel like you're in danger. So there's good reasons and bad reasons to stop talking politics, but almost two out of three of us have done it, and that's kind of worrisome. And I would say another one is that when it comes to – this is just people who are strongly approving of President Trump – but 60% of folks who are strong approvers of President Trump said that they agreed with the statement that the traditional way of American life is disappearing so fast that we may have to use force to save it. And so now saying you agree with that statement is several steps removed from engaging in actual political violence. So let's make sure that you know, caveat is there. But the fact that, you know, people are willing to say, yeah, I like the idea of using force to get what I want in this country if I'm not getting it at the ballot box is something that we should, take seriously.
Well, both of those in a way point toward a concern that, okay, a political difference isn't just a minor disagreement over policy, but potentially an existential threat. If I'm not talking to someone because of a fundamental decision, I might think that they want to end democracy as it exists, as I perceive it, and the thought of violence might be in the same category.
I think that's right, and I think part of it stems from the misperceptions we have about what it is the other side thinks, and how it is the other side gets there, how we think the other side gets their information. And so we tend to think the other side is more extreme than it actually is, and we tend to think that they live in a filter bubble of information that is an echo chamber that just tells them that they're right and that the other side is evil, whereas we, the ideal citizen, you know, get our information from a wide variety of sources and challenge our point of view. And we tend to overestimate our own willingness to engage in sort of, you know, positive information seeking and challenging our point of view. And we tend to underestimate how much other people do that. And that perception leads to some of these things that you're talking about, I think.
And I don't want to have people come away right at the outset thinking this is all bad. There's all scary stuff here. You see signs of hope, signs of ways, at least paths to rebuilding our connections.
Oh, yeah. So even though there are sharp signs of civic fracture and barriers to political participation in our state. There are lots of signs that we have paths forward that there's broad agreement on. And one of those is just when we ask people, is it better for our leaders to stick to their principles no matter what, even if nothing gets done, or compromise, even if they, you know, have to, you know, not get everything they want or compromise away something that they might prefer? 3-1, by a margin of 3-1, Wisconsinites say, let's compromise. The principles are important, but let's make some kind of progress. And that is a bipartisan feeling. Republicans and Democrats feel that in relatively equal measure. And there's a strong hunger for that. There's also 80% of us trust that our votes were counted in elections. And so that's a good number, right? We'd like it to be even higher. But in a state like Wisconsin, where turnout is almost always in the top three in the country, you know, 4 out of 5 of us think I'm very confident my vote was getting counted. That's good as well. Wisconsinites are also strongly in favor of nonpartisan redistricting, which is a fair way to apportion the way that our lawmakers end up getting to represent us. And so there's lots of paths that transcend party boundaries in our state, despite the contentious political climate that we have, especially the day before a major election in our state.
I wanted to ask about the redistricting result. As it happens, Republicans have controlled the redistricting process to their benefit. It happens the other way in other states sometimes.
Right.
But you might think, okay, well, of course, Republicans will love this. Democrats will hate it in Wisconsin. There was a difference, but still a majority of Republicans supported a different way of drawing these maps.
That's right. And that was true even for Republicans who were made aware that, hey, the current system advantages Republicans. And so it wasn't the case that Republicans in Wisconsin were saying, hey, we should hold on to our advantage here. They were saying, hey, we should probably engage in a process that's a little bit more fair. We may not always have the advantage, and when we don't, it would be better to have a fairer process. And a nonpartisan commission where one side doesn't get to dictate to the other what happens has been something that's been pretty successful in other states, and is something that a majority of Wisconsinites and a majority of Republicans would support. And, you know, it's also the case that if we engaged in a different kind of districting process in Wisconsin, it would certainly be likely to help Democrats, but it probably would not be enough to change the majority of the state legislature. So Republicans wouldn't be giving away, in all likelihood, their majority in the state Senate or state assembly, but it wouldn't be as large as it is today.
Talking to Mike Wagner with the Center for Communication and Civic Renewal at UW-Madison, looking at their work, a recent work, and over the years, looking at political and civic divides and ways to bridge them here in the state. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions or maybe experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. You know, the civil society is very important to, you know, everyone's well-being. That's, you know, we look through at history and we see where these kind of divisions lead. But everyone, whether you're a supporter of the former president or not, everyone flushes their toilet and expects it to be treated and clean water to come out of their taps and police and fire and all that. And that's what makes the civil society. So we can't, you know, let these divisions put that at risk.
Willem, thanks a lot for the call. It's an interesting point, Mike, that I think about sometimes. A lot of our society operates on huge amounts of trust that things will work in particular ways that are invisible, where we don't see the ways we're interconnected, as Willem points out.
Right, and I think Willem makes a great point that, you know, just imagine how it would completely dominate our political discourse if suddenly toilets across Wisconsin stopped working. We would be talking about, you know, sewer regulation and water treatment and all of these kinds of things that aren't headline-making issues under most circumstances, right? And it's because, I think as Willem points out, there's lots of things that government does and that politics does that happen behind the scenes in kind of a what some scholars call the submerged state. Like, you don't see it if roads are working well and if you have good Wi-Fi in your community and those kinds of things. And so a lot of that is essential to conducting business, to getting kids to school, to having a chance to do things that are fun in your community. And to the extent that we start fraying our politics to the point where we might not even trust folks to do the basics, that's where we start. That's one area where we might say we should really start to feel worried about the state of our political culture. And there are increasing examples of people saying they just don't trust people on the other side to do things. And if it comes to the point where we wouldn't, you know, we're asking a plumber their party affiliation, you know, I think that that, you know, that would be a sign that we're in some deep doo-doo.
Well, thanks for the call. Robin joins us now in Wausau. Robin, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Robin?
I have a kind of a personal situation in my neighborhood right now. One of my neighbors over the weekend put up an American flag upside down. And I'm ex-military, and when I was in the Coast Guard, one of my I was responsible for the care and protocol of using the American flag. And I find this very distressful. And I happened to look it up, and I see that there's a federal statute stating that you should only do such a thing if you're under what is the term, dire distress.
Distress, yes.
And I don't quite know what to do. I really want to say something to him. He's been a great neighbor. I mean, huh. He comes over and he's a snow blow for me. And
Robin, I interesting case. Now, I've seen, Mike, again, the official code is this is dire distress. I've seen people on the left and on the right do the upside down American flag thing as a sign, like expressing political distress. You're not a personal advice columnist, Mike,
right.
But you have thoughts on how we can have a discussion in a place where clearly we disagree, but we see some positive things about the other person too.
Well, I first of all, I think it's really a really good start that the caller's orientation is, you know, this thing makes me uncomfortable. There are things I've done in my life in service to my country that are a part of why this makes me feel uncomfortable. And I believe that my neighbor's a good person and has done nice things for me. And so, like, that is so much further down the field of what it is that we need to help civil society than saying, I'm going to make some assumptions about whoever put the flag up in that way, and I'm just going to decide that I don't like them, right? And so being willing to engage in an open conversation and just say, you know, hey, you know, we've gotten along for a long time and been good neighbors, and I just want you to know that this thing makes me uncomfortable. And you know, that...
Well, and
that,
here's his story, too, I think.
Yeah, and here's my story, and here's why, And that might open a place where, you know, the neighbor might feel, again, like as you say, not advice columnist. I'm just kind of, you know, riffing here. But you could imagine, like research about having uncomfortable conversations, you know, basically the conclusion is basically aim for the heart and not the head, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of saying, I'm right, there's a statute that says you can't do this, right? Instead, it's, this makes me uncomfortable and here's why. Why don't you tell me why you're doing it, right? Because part of what makes civil society healthy is our willingness to listen, which is different than waiting for our turn to talk, right? And so being open to, you know, if someone's doing that kind of political act, there's probably a reason or set of reasons they're doing that. And so to be open to listening to that and starting a dialogue, even if, you know, the ultimate conclusion is, well, I disagree, is healthier than developing a set of, you know, unknown assumptions about people and then, you know, treating them differently because of it. And so I think the caller is... doing the right thing, which is to think about, here's what I don't like about what's happening, and here are positive things I know about this person, which makes me not want to write them off immediately.
Robin, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Good luck in dealing with it. We're talking to UW-Madison journalism professor Mike Wagner about Wisconsin's political divides and ways we can repair civic engagement here in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about political divides in Wisconsin and beyond? Have you stopped talking to someone, period, or stopped talking to someone about politics because of differing political views, or have you found ways to keep those contacts alive and well? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Mike Wagner, journalism professor at UW-Madison and faculty director of the Center for Communication and Civic Renewal, which recently released the results of their new Civic Fracture and Renewal Survey. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you think we could find common ground when we disagree on politics? Us as people, political leaders and elected officials, whose responsibility is it to heal our political divides? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Scott is with us in Iron River. Hi, Scott.
Yes. Hi, Rob and Mike. Nice to be on today. I'll start by saying just this morning I was replying to a friend on Facebook who posted something about, you know, making sure to get out and vote tomorrow. Then he also went on to speak of his dismay for, you know, the political state, the division that is going on. And interestingly enough, as I was replying on the radio, Comfortably Numb, Pink Floyd, Comfortably Numb was on, which, aside from being one of my top five favorite rock and roll songs, that's basically what I find myself, I've become comfortably numb to all the division. And at the same time, I have a strong yearning to want to do something about it. And I'm not a good debater. I don't argue well. So when I do talk politics, and I do have a number of friends who are strong, diehard Republicans, and they're very passionate about their views. And we've come to kind of the point to agree to not talk about politics. But if we do, or if I do with anybody, it's trying to find things that we can agree on.
I gotcha. I like Scott, you've already given us a ton to work with, and I want to give Mike some time to tackle that. First of all, that technique of Scott says he's not a great debater. Well, maybe we don't need a lot of great debaters in our political conversations.
Yeah, you know, politics doesn't, at the community level, doesn't always need to be about debate or right versus left or Republicans versus Democrats. Like amongst our elected officials, like, you know, most elected officials run for office under one of those two party labels. And so it's not surprising that they organize themselves to govern that way. But a lot of problems that we need to solve transcend party politics and happen at a more local level and don't necessarily require debate as much as people saying, here are problems I'm noticing, things I'm experiencing, here are challenges I'm seeing, what ideas do we have to try to solve these problems? And our survey reveals just more and more of us think that we're not as good at solving these problems. 66% of Wisconsinites say that democracy in the United States is weaker than it used to be. You know, about one in five folks who are of lower income say that they find it really difficult to navigate the barriers to vote, and like, which is kind of the bare bones minimum of what we ought to be able to do in a democracy, and it's, we don't have equal access to that franchise. And so there's these different kinds of things happening that make it harder for us to feel like we can participate. Lots of people are uncomfortable talking politics or engaging in debate, you know, worrying about whether they have their facts right or you know, not thinking of the comeback until they're driving home, you know, and those sorts of things. And you know, not all political conversation needs to be blood sport, you know, even though our lawmakers often engage in contentious political behavior.
And briefly to Scott's point, his thought of being numb to politics, I hear from callers like disillusionment or frustration leading to wanting to get away from it. Is that something you're encountering in your work on these projects?
It is. And so this is the first in a series of reports we're going to release. And so I'll spoiler alert what's coming in April is that there's, since 2018, a growing sense of what we call news fatigue in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. People just saying there's too many things happening. There's too much of a deluge. It is making me feel anxious and tired and overwhelmed, and it's too hard to keep up. And sometimes folks who feel especially fatigued conclude, I'm gonna actively pay less attention to what's going on. And the consequence then is that if people think, well, if I don't have to pay attention to what's going on, I'm sure I'll hear about the stuff that's really important. People who have that news will find me perspective are also folks who are more likely to endorse conspiracy theories. And so the fatigue is real, but our behavior in response to the fatigue can have negative consequences downstream.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jim joins us now in Green Bay. Jim, hello. Are you there, Jim? I think we lost Jim. Jim was saying that the public might like compromise, as you mentioned in the survey, Mike, but if elected officials don't seem to, Jim says they serve their own interests. And so the disjoint between what the public might want and differing motivations for elected officials.
Yeah, I mean, there's the public, like there are Wisconsinites, but then there are Wisconsinites who vote in partisan primaries, and those are different, right? And so if a lawmaker is going to compromise with folks in the other political party, And it's something that their most ardent and most participatory supporters don't like, there could be a consequence for them in their next election. And so even though most of us say most of the time we prefer compromise, it can come at a consequence for lawmakers. And the other issue, I'll say, just a limit of our ability to conduct surveys about compromise is that, you know, we all love compromise in the abstract. Now, what if I ask you to compromise on something you really care about? Maybe you're less interested in compromise on that thing.
Let's talk a little bit about participation. That's another thing you got try to get into in the survey. What kind of things did you learn about our willingness to actually be involved?
Well, Wisconsinites are an involved people. Lots of folks engage in different kinds of political participation in Wisconsin. But there are some interesting differences in how we engage in that participation. And one of which is that about a quarter of us will say, even in our state, which is very participatory, that they avoid participating in politics because there are too many dangerous people out there. So people are saying, I'm aware that sometimes engaging in a public protest or some other kind of public-facing political event is something that could actually put my safety at risk. And so that kind of belief keeps about a quarter of us, according to the survey, in our state from participating. Those numbers are notably higher for Black Wisconsinites and Jewish and Muslim Wisconsinites. So groups that aren't in a numerical majority in the state especially feel that kind of danger.
And Mike, as we wrap up, you spoiled it a little bit. What is the timeline on the next bit of findings from your survey research?
So we interviewed about 3,000 Wisconsinites before the 2022 midterm elections, and we are interviewing as many of those as we can right now, actually, in the field. And so we're going to wrap up these interviews in the next couple of days so that we'll have talked to the same people twice and see how things change over time and do a report dealing more with our media use and our social media use and online media use and how those things are associated with our attitudes and behaviors.
Sounds like a good reason to bring you back in a while.
We'd love it.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner, journalism professor, faculty director of the Center for Communication and Civic Renewal at UW-Madison. He was with us today to share his organization's new Civic Fracture and Renewal Survey results. You can keep sharing your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, some local governments are changing their budget process by getting the public more involved. Find out how participatory budgeting works and the impact it can have on community involvement and local decisions. That's tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Do you like to swim? Do you ever swim underwater? I'll go a couple feet under the surface myself. Anything past that, my ears hurt a little. And I've never done scuba diving, probably never will. But here's something that swims a little deeper than I do, to the tune of 27,000 feet underwater. As reported by CNN, a deep sea project led by Japanese and Australian scientists has captured video of the deepest swimming fish ever caught on tape. It's a kind of snail fish. From the pictures, you might look and say, that's a fish? They're pinkish, translucent, kind of slimy looking. To this untrained observer, anyway. They live at the bottom of an ocean trench, and by swimming so low, they avoid a lot of those ocean predators. How do you get a picture of a fish 27,000 feet below the sea with a $200,000 underwater robot built precisely for the job? Well, I'm only going to see things maybe right there on the shore, and I'm not going to invest in that kind of machinery. But hey, I'm looking forward to finding more results. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll take a look at PFAS chemicals and their path from consumer products to water supplies. Now, the audience for women's basketball is booming after the NCAA tournament wrapped up yesterday. This year's championship game featured the Iowa Hawkeyes and National Player of the Year Caitlin Clark. They faced off against Louisiana State Tigers, led by Coach Kim Mulkey. In the end, LSU's balanced attack brought home the title.
Kim Mulkey, in year two, has orchestrated a turnaround for the ages. LSU has captured its very first national championship.
According to ESPN, viewership for the women's game is on the rise. This year's Final Four audience was up 66% over last season, and the semifinal game between Iowa and South Carolina got more viewers than any NBA game broadcast this year on ESPN. Sally Jenkins is a sports columnist for The Washington Post. She was the first woman to be inducted into the National Sportscasters and Sportswriters Hall of Fame. And she was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2019. She's been covering the women's basketball tournament. Sally, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
I mentioned some of those audience numbers were seeing a big boost in viewership. It seems like a lot of excitement and momentum around the tournament. How would you describe this moment in women's basketball?
Well, it felt like a real crossroads for the game. People have been expecting some sort of breakthrough moment like this for a number of years, actually. The numbers have been growing steadily. But the 66% rise in viewership, a peak of 6 million viewers who watched Iowa and South Carolina in the semifinals, and 357,000 in paid in-person attendance. Those are really big numbers. That something really changed this week.
And the tournament had great games, big-name players now. What were some of the, storylines that you thought made this year so entertaining?
Well, the player of the year, Caitlin Clark, was certainly a huge factor, dropping 40 points, in two consecutive tournament games, and then making it all the way to the championship game with the Iowa Hawkeyes. That was, I think, catnip for viewers. She's such a great offensive player. Really extraordinary. She was being compared to Pete Maravich, really a crowd pleasing offensive player. And then you had very popular teams with growing fan bases like South Carolina, where Dawn Staley, the Olympic gold medal winning head coach, has been building a really strong audience in South Carolina. And the same with Kim Mulkey, who's another Hall of Famer at Louisiana State, who of course won the whole thing. You're talking about women who've been working to really build deep fan bases for quite some years, and I think you're just seeing the payoff for that.
Now, looking back, I did some counting. For about 30 years, if you'd bet at the beginning of a season that either Tennessee or Connecticut was going to win it all, you would have been right 19 out of 30 times. There's that dominance by a couple teams. Is part of the excitement here that we're seeing more and more teams, entering the picture and becoming competitive?
Well, I think there's something to that. UConn obviously always drew really, really large numbers, and so did Tennessee. I mean, the Pat Summitt teams and the Geno Auriemma teams with Diana Taurasi, certainly commanded very, very large numbers. But the consistency, the year in and year out, week in and week out, attendance and viewership throughout this tournament was really a significant change. And that's where I think that, yes, you do see the fact that UConn hasn't won the national championship since 2016, may have opened the door to, again, build some programs into prominence like South Carolina and Dawn Staley, Iowa, and Caitlin Clark.
Now, for the popularity of a sport, it depends in some ways on how much the media covers it, but sometimes sports media will not want to cover a sport if they don't perceive it as possible. How have you seen that chicken or egg question playing out with ultimately more media exposure for women's college basketball?
Well, I can just give you one very direct example, which was I used to be the only person from my newspaper that would cover the women's Final Four. I would be there by myself. I usually requested to cover it. We would have sent somebody if I hadn't volunteered. But this time we had three people there. I was one of three from the Washington Post. We just have really, the Washington Post, the New York Times, USA Today, and ESPN, I think, and other national outlets have recognized that the audience, the readership was huge. I mean, yesterday, like every single story on our best read list was a women's basketball story. And we're talking on a Sunday when you have you also had, some rather big events going on the men's side. So you had NBA games, you had, the men's championship coming up. So it was really, really interesting to see.
When it comes to the day-to-day experience of student athletes, what do you think this jump in popularity could change?
Well, one in three American girls now plays a varsity sport, is my understanding. It's gone from being something that, very, very narrow. It was a marginal pursuit for young women when I was young. And it's become something that American women, have made the shift from the ornamental to the active, if you will. I think there's just been a seismic change. You can see it culturally in everything from fashion to physique. These teams, along with the U.S. women's soccer team, which has been a really gigantic factor in terms of influencing young women's tastes and habits. I think all of these things have sort of been converging for several years now. But the women's basketball, this particular tournament, you had a sense that something that had been brewing for a long, long time really came to a head.
Are you seeing that enthusiasm at the college level translate into the professional game in the WNBA?
Well, that's right. And one, you know, I mean, let's another storyline here was the rivalry between Angel Reese of LSU and Caitlin Clark. And there was some, you know, a bit of taunting at the end of the game by Angel Reese. And there's obviously a very hot debate going on social media today. And so one of the, you know, interesting questions is, have women reached such a state of gender equity that trash talking, you know, has become mainstream in women's sports? So, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon to see people debating women's basketball around the water cooler on a Monday, the way they used to really reserve that time only for men's sports.
All right. Well, the season is over now. You're catching your breath, I have assumed, from doing a lot of coverage. But what are you watching for in the next season now?
Well, I think Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark are both back for their schools. And also most of the players for Virginia Tech, which also made it to the Final Four, was a surprise factor in the Final Four. They're all returning. I think you can look for some personal rivalries. You'll see some reprises. You'll see, I think, a comeback by the University of Connecticut. They should be healthy next year and a factor again. And Dawn Staley is hunting her third national championship and was disappointed in the semifinal. And so South Carolina will have a chip on its shoulder. So I think you're going to have a really intense season next season. And what's interesting about that particularly is that the women's media rights are up for renegotiation. And what might have happened here with this tournament is it may have really jacked up the going rate to buy the television rights for NCAA women's basketball in 2024. I mean, we could have been looking at a $100 million tournament, that just completed. That could be the financial impact of having had such an exciting event that drew so many eyes at a time when a contract is expiring and up for new negotiations.
Sally, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
That's Sally Jenkins, sports columnist at the Washington Post, member of the National Sportscasters and Sports Writers Hall of Fame. She joined us for a look at the record-setting audience numbers for this year's NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a tribute to a beloved basketball coach.
The men's NCAA basketball tournament is wrapping up, and it caps a season in which Marquette University won a game in the tournament. And the occasion brings to mind the late coach Al McGuire, whose Marquette basketball teams won 79% of their games. In 1977, in McGuire's final game as a coach, Marquette won the program's only national championship. McGuire's legacy transcends sports. The way he looked at the world, the way he expressed himself, made him a true original. Milwaukee journalist Tom Kircher, who authored a book on McGuire, reflects on the coach's magic with words.
As a sports fan growing up near Milwaukee, I admired Al McGuire's success in coaching basketball at Marquette University. Decades later, I did a book on Al McGuire because he was not your typical sports figure. Al was witty, acutely attentive to the world around him, and surprisingly sentimental. His words are worth remembering as March Madness winds down. First, Al's wit. Here are two of his bon mots. If the waitress has dirty ankles, the chili is good. The only mystery in life is why kamikaze pilots wore helmets. Yes, Al was a character. He once described how he took precautions to keep his players out of trouble in Milwaukee. We had someone from the FBI talk to us before the season, Al recalled. He told us there were three places in town we should declare off limits. I had been hanging out in two of them. Al was a bit of a street philosopher. Here's a quote of his that's fitting for Wisconsin. There's a nice feeling at 2 a.m. to see a beer sign. It's somewhere you can place a bet or have an affair or play a jukebox or whatever. Of all the places I know on earth, it seems to be the most wholesome. You're not walking into anything that you have to prep yourself for. When you go in, You know what's there and what's expected of you. If you want to join in, you can. If you want to slip down to the end of the bar and cry in your beer, you can do that too. Perhaps my favorite quality of Al's was that he embraced his sensitive side. Like when he talked about what he expected of his team. I see either roses or weeds, Al said. It's definitely going to depend upon if the players really love each other or just make believe. It all gets down to love. If we have love, we'll be good. If we don't, we'll be bad. Al took time to reflect on life, like how that national championship affected him. You get compassion, he said. You lose the soot on your face. Let your hair grow. Put on your beach shoes. You lose your obnoxiousness, your surliness. The game isn't everything because you become more intelligent. You see more. Al McGuire passed away in 2001. He had some observations near the end, too. The doctors tell me that when I start to cough, it's pretty much over for me in 3 days. So I don't cough. There's this big gray elephant in the room, and nobody wants to talk about it. But I know. But Al would go out with a smile. I'm moving towards the dancing lights, he said. Dancing lights and a soft landing.
Milwaukee journalist Tom Kircher brought us that story on former Marquette University basketball coach Al McGuire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we follow the trail of PFAS chemicals, from everyday consumer goods like toilet paper to the contamination found in our rivers, lakes, and fresh water supplies. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new study from the University of Florida finds that toilet paper should be considered a potential source of PFAS chemicals entering wastewater treatment systems. Researchers there looked at 21 major toilet paper brands from the U.S. and around the world. They found traces of these so-called forever chemicals in all of them. PFAS is a group of over 6,000 synthetic chemicals found in the consumer products we use every day. Anything that's nonstick, stain-resistant, grease-resistant, or waterproof might have PFAS chemicals in them. Plus, it's a big part of some firefighting technology. Even at low concentrations, some PFAS chemicals have been linked to negative health outcomes like thyroid disease, diabetes, and cancer. Our next guest has been researching PFAS contamination in Wisconsin and says most of the contamination in our state has been found in groundwater, our largest source of drinking water. Christy Remicall is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering, director of the Water Science and Engineering Laboratory, and co-director of the Core Facility for Advanced Water Analysis at UW-Madison. Christy, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We've got this study saying six different PFAS compounds in toilet paper. The American Forest and Paper Association says we're not adding these to toilet paper. What do you think of yet another product on the list of potential sources of PFAS chemicals?
Well, I mean, you're right. I feel like we hear about new places that have PFAS every day. PFAS have been found in other paper products as well. So on one hand, it's not a surprise. It's a little unclear why they're in toilet paper. But we also know that there is plenty of PFAS that makes its way to wastewater treatment plants. And so it does make sense that they're there.
Now, you've been following this story in Wisconsin for some time now. What, as far as we know right now, what are the main sources of these PFAS chemicals in our water here in Wisconsin?
Well, when we look here in Wisconsin specifically, as you said in the intro, a lot of our contamination is found in groundwater, which is our really highly important water resource in the state. In many cases, contamination is associated with the use of PFAS-containing firefighting foams. And so we often find high concentrations near airports or military installations. There are other sources as well, but those are some of the big ones that we think about.
Now, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, last month proposed limiting levels in drinking water to pretty low levels that tests are able to detect. That would put a lot of communities here in Wisconsin at higher than recommended levels. What are you looking at when you look at standards to say, okay, this much is safe, this much isn't?
Right. Well, it's great that the EPA is finally putting out proposed standards. It's long overdue that we have federal regulations for these chemicals because we know they're toxic at low concentrations. You know, the concentrations they proposed as standards were quite a bit higher than the health advisories, and they were trying to balance, you know, having utilities be able to meet these requirements with protecting human health. And so, like I said, they're long overdue that we have standards being proposed.
What do you see as the best way to try to keep PFAS out of our water in the future? What would be your number one strategy?
Well, exactly what you said is keeping, the most important thing we can do is keeping these chemicals from getting in the environment in the first place. So decreasing their use in firefighting foams is a good example, but also decreasing their use in consumer products, things that we use every day. So people can choose to pick products that don't have PFAS. Anything we can do to prevent these chemicals from getting in the environment in the first place is important because they're so persistent and mobile. They last such a long time. So it's really, prevention is the key approach here.
They're in so many products, presumably because they are useful in making things nonstick mm-hmm. or making effective firefighting foams. Is there a thought that these are replaceable for the things we want, or at least if not, that the benefits of getting rid of them outweigh the cost of not using them?
You're absolutely right. They are really, you know, that these chemicals have a lot of great applications, and so they're in things that we love. You know, think about your Teflon pan at home. It's nice to not have to scrub to clean off your pan. However, there are definitely alternatives. You know, we use cast iron and things like that at my house. There are different things you can use. Lots of different products coming out there as, you know, companies are starting to make more products that don't have PFAS because of increased attention to them. And so there are alternatives we can choose for many cases.
If we were today somehow to stop all PFAS use, how long would it take to deal with the chemicals that are already in our groundwater and other water systems?
Oh, goodness, you're right. I mean, we do have quite a legacy of contamination to deal with. You know, some of the chemicals that we're measuring and finding in our water were put there decades ago. And, you know, as you mentioned, we're really concerned about very low concentrations in our water. And so we have quite a bit of work to do to clean up the mess that already exists.
Now, we've got communities like Wausau trying to treat all the water for PFAS, and seeing some financial shortfalls. Eau Claire planning to build a filtration addition to its water treatment plant. A lot of communities. What goes into filtering PFAS out of water supplies?
Yeah, and what we're doing now with a lot of the water treatment applications is filtering the PFAS out, and then you have this contaminated filter that you have to deal with at the end. We don't yet have a good large-scale destructive technology for these chemicals. This is something that's happening at the research stage right now. But you can basically think about many of these filters, they use activated carbon. That's the most common one. It's kind of like a really big Brita filter, and that's what's removing the PFAS from municipal water treatment supplies. And you're right, they can be quite costly, especially for small utilities.
A key here is, you know, some pollutants, they're going to break down on their own over time. People call PFAS forever chemicals. Really, these, they just don't break down, at least on a human timeline?
There are, you know, so the ones that we worry about, like PFOS and PFOA, do not have any known natural degradation processes that we know about right now. They do last a very long time. Some PFAS do degrade, and they transform into the ones that don't degrade. And so, you know, like PFOA is a really good example. They last a very long time, and that's why they're called forever chemicals.
We're obviously concerned about drinking water here in the state. How about Great Lakes and water finding its way in there? Is this becoming a substantial problem, potentially an environmental risk there?
PFAS have been measured in every environment on the planet. Of course, they're found in the Great Lakes. The concentrations tend to increase as you move from like the Western Lakes, like Superior is relatively low compared to Erie and Ontario, where concentrations are higher. And you worry about concentrations in fish in some of these lakes. PFAS have really been found around the planet. You know, even in the Arctic, places far away from people, you find PFAS really everywhere. It's really a global issue.
And your work, just in our last few moments, involves PFAS in rivers and streams that go into Green Bay and the Great Lakes. Briefly, what is a big question you're still tackling?
Yeah, so we're looking at where these chemicals are coming from. So in rivers, as well as groundwater that's coming into the lake, we're looking at sources of these chemicals and really how these chemicals move in the environment. And the idea is to not, you know, if you can understand where they're coming from, prevent pollution. And then if you know kind of where they're ending up, thinking about how to inform remediation efforts in the future.
Christy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks.
Christy Remekal is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering, director of the Water Science and Engineering Laboratory, and co-director of the Core Facility for Advanced Water Analysis at UW-Madison. She joined us today with a look at how PFAS chemicals are contaminating our water supply and what we can do to prevent it in the future. This is a story in your community. Love to hear about it. Maybe it's something we could tackle in a future show or pass on to our news team for that matter. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. Senate voted to end the use of force authorization originally granted for the Iraq War 20 years ago. We'll look at the decision and how that authorization has been used over the years. Plus, a legendary adventure returns to the big screen with turtles and mushrooms. We'll look at the pop culture role of Mario. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we've got your number, 100 of them, actually. We'll talk to the co-author of a new book, Settling 100 Debates About Which Athlete Throughout History Gets to Own Their Number. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.